You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, this is Josh Levine, and this is Slate's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen, for the week of November 13th, 2017. On this week's show, Sports Illustrated's Grant Wall will join us to talk about the fierce competition. Maybe it's a titanic struggle or an epic brawl to take the top position at U.S. Soccer, where businessy dudes and former players are vying to become the group's next president. And our old pal Mike Pesca will join us for a mid-season cavalcade of whimsy, wherein we'll look at the NFL's renaissance of end zone celebration, the University of Miami's turnover chain, and locker room speeches that may or may not inspire teams to victory. Joining me in Washington, D.C. is Stefan Fatsis, author of the books Word Freak and A Few Seconds of Panic. Hello, Stefan. Or should I say, go out there and win the podcast, Stefan.
Fight, team. We're going to go out there and we're going to do it today. We're going to podcast our best.
I'm like so stoked right now. I could run through.
That was
like
my Newt Rockne impersonation, and we'll play that clip later.
I could run through one of those egg crate-shaped things that are on the wall of our podcast studio for sound dampening purposes. That's how pumped I am. Stefan, would you like to intro our first segment?
I would. It was a big, big week for U.S. soccer, the women's national team gearing up for qualifying next year for the 2019 Women's World Cup. They tied and won friendlies against rival Canada, and the men's national team, featuring household names like Kellen Rowe, Lyndon Gooch, Weston McKennie, and Josh Sargent, is in Portugal for a friendly on Tuesday that kicks off the United States' run to qualify for the 2022 World Cup in Qatar. Proceeds from the game will benefit victims of wildfires in central and northern Portugal.
We've got that.
Back home in the aftermath of the men's failure to qualify for the next World Cup in Russia next year, the field is indeed getting crowded to elect a president of the U.S. Soccer Federation. Grant Wall writes about soccer for Sports Illustrated. He is here. Hey, Grant.
Hey, how are you?
Let's start with the aftermath of the men's disaster. Bruce Arena is out as coach, as expected. Only three players who suited up in the loss to Trinidad that ensured failure are with the team in Portugal. Josh Sargent, whom I just mentioned, played in the U-17 World Cup. Do you expect the new beginnings to continue here, Grant? Have we seen the last of Clint Dempsey, Tim Howard, Michael Bradley on the national team?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know if we've seen the very last of them. Clint Dempsey is currently tied with Landon Donovan as the all-time leading goal scorer for the U.S. men's national team. My guess is Dempsey will get some opportunities to try and break that record. As far as Tim Howard's concerned, I do think, as people have been saying, once this horrible loss happened to Trinidad, preparation for World Cup 22 has started. And so In my opinion, as many young players of the future should be called in as possible right now. And that's kind of what we're seeing for this Portugal friendly.
So there is a history of recriminations in U.S. soccer, a very recent history. In the Klinsmann era, even before Klinsmann got canned, there were pieces. There was a famous one by Brian Strauss with anonymous players sniping at the coach and his tactics or lack thereof. Is it just me, or has there been a little bit less of that from the players? Is that because it's like pretty obvious that everyone is to blame for what happened in Trinidad and throughout the cycle? Or is there in the U.S. locker room on the roster, are there players who are kvetching about Bruce Arena, about Sunil Gulati, about the position that they were put in and the fact that the team didn't qualify?
I do think the players are smart enough to realize that they played a huge role in the U.S. not qualifying for World Cup 2018. And so we haven't seen any situations of U.S. players complaining about Bruce Arena or Jurgen Klinsmann or Sunil Gulati, the U.S. soccer president. The closest thing we got was Jeff Cameron, who was really not used much at all under Bruce Arena, having some sort of cryptic messages on Twitter questioning the formation that Arena had with the team. I think it is crazy that Jeff Cameron, who plays week in and week out in the Premier League, was not a part of the last several U.S. games in this run of failure. So it's not on him. So if anyone has a right to complain, maybe it's him. But this was plenty of blame to go around.
And plenty of blame has been passed around, indeed, since the loss. Arena gone, calls for Sunil Gulati to step down or to not run again for president. And one of the most obvious effects of the debacle is that there is a huge field of people who are now running to be president, hoping to succeed Gulati. Gulati's already been in there for 12 years. He's going for one more term, right? Grant, this would give him 16 years as president of U.S. soccer. But now he's got a lot of opposition. He hasn't even declared that he's going to run again. The election is in February.
Rick Santorum is in there. Mike Huckabee. Herman Cain.
Yeah.
Carly Fiorina, I think, is a contender.
I mean, the question right now is who is not running for U.S. soccer president? We've got seven candidates who have announced, and Sunil Gulati, who's been president the last 12 years, has not announced yet whether he's going to run or not. Clearly, the timing of this situation has created some chaos. The U.S. failing to qualify for the World Cup for the first time since 1986. And here we have a once every 4 years presidential election in U.S. soccer in early February. So what a lot of people thought would be Gulati's coronation for one final four-year term has suddenly thrown everything wide open, because even Gulati's right-hand man, Vice President Carlos Cordero, has announced he's running for U.S. soccer president in sort of an et tu brute moment. And you've got plenty of other people running, including former players like Eric Winalda, Kyle Martino, Paul Caligiuri. You've got lawyers who are running. And we'll see if the field thins out a little bit. Nominations are due by December 12th, and you have to have at least three nominations from state associations around the country to even be an official candidate. So you might see a few less folks at that point, but the actual election will be February 10th in Orlando.
This is really weird. I mean, the way U.S. soccer is governed and the way this election takes place is bizarre. This is like some sort of East Bloc voting procedure. It's, you know, there are all of these different councils and committees, adult soccer, youth soccer, professional soccer. They all have a percentage of votes in this thing. And you've got this clusterfuck of candidates now that have declared, all of whom are sort of running on the men's team failure to qualify for the World Cup. It's
and to be
weird.
Clear, the women are under U.S. soccer, too, and there are no women candidates.
And there are no women candidates, and they're the most successful entity within the U.S. soccer structure.
Yeah, there's so much to talk about there, but it's a great point. Very, very few women in the leadership of U.S. soccer right now. Where are the women who could be terrific presidential candidates? People like Julie Foudy, people like Mary Harvey, who has experience at FIFA, maybe even Mia Hamm. Why are they not running? Well, they're not running for a couple of reasons. One of them is that U.S. soccer president is an unpaid job, and I feel like that needs to change, because if you want to attract talented people, you got to pay them. And two, because there's this tradition of women not necessarily being treated well or respected by the leadership of U.S. soccer. And when you look at the people who are actually voting delegates in this election in February, a very small percentage of them will be women. So even though U.S. soccer has, thanks to Title IX in many ways, given more opportunities to women to play the game over the years at a high level, there's still a very big gender problem in U.S. soccer.
So I was looking at this list of the candidates. ESPN FC has one. You've run through them as well, Grant. I'm just trying to figure out, like, who should I support? Or, like, even if I'm in favor of, like, something from column A or something from column B, like, what do these people stand for? I don't even know. Like, one thing I guess that I was surprised by is that promotion and relegation seems like it's a huge talking point here. I know that when we ask for when we have a call-in show, that, like, a bunch of, like, random hang up and listen listeners, you're not random, you're all beautiful individuals, like, that's an issue that people that listen to our show care about, promotion and relegation, that it should come to U.S. sports, but that this is, like, a huge deal among the people who could potentially lead U.S. soccer was surprising to me. Like, what else is there? Like, what are the things distinguishing these candidates from each other?
Another topic that is getting a lot of attention in this election campaign is simply wanting to make the leadership of U.S. soccer focus more on the soccer side of things instead of just on the business side, because U.S. soccer is doing very well from a business perspective. They've got a surplus now in excess of $130 million and need to figure out how to spend that. But in terms of getting better on the soccer side, at least on the men's side, that is not happening clearly. And so I think some of the candidates are trying to sell themselves as, I can improve things on the soccer side. Look at my background as a player or as an administrator who will be more willing to hire a soccer general manager to run things or a soccer-y technical community to make coaching hires, which is a big part of what the leadership of U.S. soccer does. There's a lot of questions about whether giving Jurgen Klinsmann an extension and a promotion before the 2014 World Cup was smart, or letting him stay in as long as he was before he got fired was a smart move, because then there was a chain reaction of problems that resulted.
The risk here, of course, is that you throw the baby out with the bathwater, that we criticize Sunil Gulati and say, we need something totally different. We need a player to run things. And the truth is that Kyle Martino and Paul Caligiuri and Eric Winalda, as well-meaning as they might be, are players, former players. They are not business people, and it would be foolish to discount how influential Sunil Gulati has been, both in raising the level of the business side of U.S. soccer, but also raising the profile and impact that the United States has in world soccer. And I think I worry about that sort of, about losing sight of the fact that this is a job that's not about who's going to be the next coach of the men's national team. It's a job that is about many, many things, including the structure of development in U.S. soccer, but also the relationship of the United States in the rest of the world, right?
No, I think that's true. And I think one thing that Sunil Gulati has done that you cannot criticize him for is raising the profile and influence of the United States in FIFA, where he's on the FIFA board, the FIFA council. And clearly Gulati is the head of the World Cup bid committee for 2026, which has a very good chance of bringing the World Cup back to North America in 26. So those are important roles that he has built, and I think he deserves a ton of credit for that. What I would say about the business side of U.S. soccer is the credit for that goes to Dan Flynn, who has been the CEO since 2000. He has that as his everyday job, building the business, and he gets paid quite well to do that, as opposed to the presidency position, which is an unpaid job. So Dan Flynn, still the CEO, General Secretary of U.S. soccer. And so on the business side, despite missing out on the World Cup, things still look very promising for the U.S. I do think that you need to have someone come in who has good soccer instincts and can get a group of smart soccer people together to plot out the future of U.S. soccer.
I don't want our listeners to think that we've just spent 15 minutes wasting their time. But if it's like, if it's the CEO who's in charge of running the business, if the presidency is an unpaid position, why not just put in some like figurehead? Does this actually matter? Are we only talking about this because we're desperate for something to talk about? Because it's actually just coming across the wires. The U.S. is not going to be in the 2018 World Cup.
There's certainly an argument to be made that we're putting way too much importance on this U.S. soccer presidential election just because there's so many people running and it's something to talk about. And you could argue that you need someone who is going to be a consensus builder, who is going to lead the board of directors of U.S. soccer as U.S. soccer president. And I do think it's important that you have someone who is inclusive. The reputation that Sunil Gulati has gotten over the years is that he is a very active president who doesn't like to delegate, who likes to be in control of just about everything. And there's certainly a feeling that that needs to change, that the president who comes in should probably be like some of Gulati's predecessors, who were more inclusive and not having control of just about every decision.
You interviewed Landon Donovan last week for SI, and his first answer when asked why he's not running was, one, I'm not remotely qualified for that job. Two, I would have no idea how to even begin that job. Three, I don't want to do that job. And four, there are better ways for me to be involved and impactful. That might also apply to the other players who are running for this position.
Can I just interrupt and say that actually made me want him to be?
Yes, I was president. Just going to say that after refinishing your interview, I was like, oh my God, I mean, I'm in the bag for Donovan and always have been. But after reading that, it was like, this is perfect. He is someone that's willing to learn, has really smart ideas about some very basic things that need to change nationally in the way we approach development in youth soccer, and seems really willing now to get involved because, as he said, which I also thought was impressive, he feels partly responsible, even though he wasn't on this team, for not doing more and for the U.S. not qualifying.
Dude is humble and self-aware, which is something that you can rarely say about someone who is throwing his hat into the ring for president of any organization.
No, it's true. I mean, I think Donovan realizes that in some ways being U.S. soccer president is a thankless job. And to get votes, remember, it's not the fans who are voting in this election. It's a bunch of delegates from U.S. youth soccer and U.S. adult amateur soccer and the Athletes Council. It's a, you know, a bunch of people that nobody's ever heard of and have different ideas of what they want as constituents that may not align and probably don't align in many ways with the average fan. So that's something I learned when I ran for FIFA president back in 2011.
I forgot about that.
Which, yeah, one of my fun experiences over time was that, you know, we had a poll on the Sports Illustrated website which said, you know, here's Grant Wall, Sepp Blatter, who would you vote for? And I got like 99% of the vote, but anybody would have gotten 99% of the vote because the world's fans and U.S. soccer fans aren't really represented in elections.
All right, before we let you go, Grant, a little handicapping here. Kyle Martino, Eric Winalda, they have big public personalities. They have had platforms on television, so everyone's going to know who they are, obviously. The business folks here, Carlos Cordero, has experience inside the U.S. Soccer Federation. I don't think this guy, Paul LaPointe, is going to win. He's the Northeast Conference manager in the Semi-Pro United Premier Soccer League. But he also did start the Massachusetts Twisters indoor pro team. When you look at this field and the kind of person that this broad membership might be likely to vote for, what do you see happening here?
It's really up in the air at this point. So much depends on whether Sunil Gulati decides to run again and how much anger will remain toward him among the voters about the U.S. men missing the World Cup. I think also when you look at some things to watch, I guess, there's 20% of the vote is provided by the Athletes Council, which is a group of current and former players. And they tend to vote as a block, and they could potentially swing the election with whoever they decide to vote for. And also the pro side of things has a lot of influence, about 24% of the vote. And Don Garber, the commissioner of MLS, could have a very big influence on how the pro side votes. I would look right now at those two areas, the Athletes Council and the pros, as probably going to be the main deciders in the election.
Grant Wall covers soccer for Sports Illustrated. He's got a new book coming out next May. It's called Masters of Modern Soccer, How the World's Best Play the 21st Century Game. Buy it. Grant, thanks, man.
Enjoyed it.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Before we get to the 2017 Hang Up and Listen Whimsy Spectacular, a heads up that in our bonus segment for Slate Plus members, we will talk about the latest in the Jerry Jones versus Roger Goodell NFL owner versus commissioner standoff, and Papa John is involved. To hear that conversation, please join Slate Plus for just $35 per year. If you do, you can get a Slate tote bag and bonus segments on this and other Slate podcasts every week. Sign up at slate.com/hangupplus. For our next segment, it's going to be a Hang Up and Listen Mega Block Power Hour, commercial free. We've got Mike Pesca in here, a former member of the Hang Up and Listen panel. Hello, Mike.
Family. I like to think of it as the family.
Great to have you on, my friend. So we hung your vocal cords from the rafters, and don't worry because we had them cleaned.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not dripping on us, but it's kind of the best we could do. There wasn't really a jersey situation. So we thought, what better way to honor Mike Pesca than to get some desiccated larynx in the DC studio?
My nodes.
Your nodules are wafting in the room. So the one thing that we did retire, since the jersey was not an option, was Whimsy Watch. That was the real kind of Pesca flavor, little Pesca marinade in the Hang Up and Listen salmon. The notion was that we were searching for like whimsical items and the most non-whimsical entity in the sporting scene, right, Stefan?
Yeah, particularly in the NFL.
Particularly to the NFL. So as soon as Mike goes on to spend more time with his family or whatever it is that he's doing, the gist, among other things, the NFL relaxes its celebration rules. And now there has been what I would describe as a whimsy renaissance, Mike.
Yeah. A whimsissance. It's the whims happening. I think that, I guess you could say that ratings are down 8% since they allowed touchdown celebrations. Some would blame other factors, but I actually think they've been tremendous. I enjoyed the Vikings playing leapfrog. I enjoy a lot of cell phone. It would be interesting to contrast this period of celebration, legal celebration, with the old. I think there's a lot of technology-inflected celebrations using the ball as a cell phone. That comes up quite a bit. Players passing it to each other. I can't get a signal. That sort of thing, using it as a touchpad. But it's great. I mean, it's just great. That's the thing I show my kids to hook them and then try to indoctrinate them into a lifetime of rooting for a sport that causes brain damage.
I think that this is actually, you bring up a good point, Mike, which is this is probably material for like a PhD thesis, right? A dissertation comparing the two eras of celebration in the NFL and how they more broadly have affected our appreciation of and ratings and interest in the National Football League.
That was amazing. It was like, based on what I think everyone out there is listening, I think Mike just gave a little dissertation abstract. That's what we were all thinking. Well,
dusting it with dissertation fodder, yeah.
We talked about this forever, that this was such an easy win
for the NFL.
And just like there are so many things to criticize the NFL for, but this was almost the cleanest hit because it's just like so obviously stupid that they didn't allow guys to dance in the end zone or do whatever it is that they're doing. And it's been totally borne out. And then I think they're being, Mike mentioned the ratings. I think they're getting their karma for not allowing this for so long because nobody cares. They're not getting like the I mean, I guess people do care, but they're not getting the positive bump that they would have gotten in past years because people are so exercised about the protests.
Yeah. Well, the protests and everything else and Zeke Elliott and Goodell's contract and every other non-football related piece of information that emanates from the NFL every week.
But don't you think, Mike, like if this had happened in like 2013 or whenever, that like there would be like a Sports Illustrated cover that's like, the NFL is fun again.
Yeah, yeah. If it had happened during the period when ratings were going up and ratings were going to go up regardless of these little ancillary things, this would be credited as a thing that the NFL has gotten right, a thing that the NFL has, or wrong, they quickly corrected. It would be like, have you noticed that in the last year or two with ratings down, no one is talking about how the NFL is smart and proactive on fantasy sports? What, everyone stopped playing fantasy football? No, more people than ever. It's just that when the huge macro trend, which has everything to do with, you know, cord cutting and all the things you talk about and the fact that there's only one good team, when the huge macro trend trends down, everyone rushes to all the negative explanations. When it was going up, every little good thing that they were doing was credited to it. It's just, you know, it's simple human heuristics and trying to explain a complex phenomenon with, stupid explanations. I would have to say, if I want to throw another PhD dissertation, I'd like someone to do the bar chart on where the miming is coming from in America. Because 2 years ago, I mean, most of the miming, like your pie chart on where you'd find miming, things like street corners and perhaps, you know, your rare Commedia dell'arte performance. Now, the vast majority of miming that people experience is from NFL players having scored.
And I want to say here that I think that the layoff in celebrations and celebrations has been good for the creative abilities of football players.
Yeah, yeah.
The NFL is like it's like a theater improv class now. It's like, all right, let's do a scene, everybody, where you're arresting somebody on the street, which is exactly what the Washington football team players did in the end zone a few weeks ago after a game-sealing interception. The players did a stop and frisk that ended with defensive back Kendall Fuller getting cuffed and arrested.
It's great. That's why, by the way, that's why the NBA should lay fallow the slam dunk competition. It's hard to beat it every year. You give it a rest for 4 years. When it comes back, people will have this, built up shtick that they're going to unveil on the league.
All right, Stefan, if there's one thing that I learned in 7+ years of doing the podcast with the three of us, it's that you take the best notes. So for that reason, and among many reasons, I'm going to let you run through the best NFL celebrations of the year to date.
All right, great. And then we can just jump in and talk about which ones we like. The Eagles, during the World Series, did a home run, little baseball pitch home run. There was an umpire involved. I thought that was nice.
They also did a hit by pitch. There was a sequel.
Yep. Yeah. And Devonta Freeman. And the Falcons took a shot after scoring touchdowns. It was a little basketball reference. One of the offensive linemen held his arms in a circle like you were playing in your living room with your little brother.
I like that one. Yeah. Packers bobsledding was a good one.
The cool, Vikings. Cool runnings vibe there.
The Vikings have run through a bunch of elementary school games. They did the leapfrog that Mike mentioned. They did duck, duck, goose. What else do we got here? The Chiefs potato sack race was, I think, a classic, an instant classic. the Steelers.
The Steelers have been good. I think the Steelers and the Vikings, Mike, are running 1-2 in terms of creativity and regularity in their performances.
Yeah. Yeah, isn't this just more joyous than ticking off phrases like, you know, the cover two? Like to say duck, duck, goose, isn't that just better?
The Steelers, Juju Smith-Schuster and Le'Veon Bell have developed a sort of like Key and Peele tag team approach. They did a hide and seek 1 week. And then
Sunday. And that was for its pure joy, by the way. Juju Smith-Schuster running and hiding behind the goalpost.
youngest
was really lovely. Yeah.
Youngest player in the NFL, so he has some old, recent life experience. All right, and the most recent one that Smith-Schuster and Bell did was reenacting the AJ Green Jalen Ramsey fight, which I'm gonna say that like that one, as well as the stop and frisk one, Mike, it opens up so many possibilities for social commentary. I was thinking that the next time, maybe it's Smith-Schuster and Bell, they've shown a real kind of dramatic range. Mm-hmm. Next time that one of them scores, they should reenact the entire NFL season thus far. And they, or maybe it's like a synecdoche New York Jets sort of thing, where, you know, when Bilal Powell gets into the end zone, he could just do like the entire history of the New York Jets. And it would take like more than 40 years, 50 years maybe, for him to just do like, you know, every game by game. And then by the time that he was done, we'd be ready to resume our contest.
Or when the ref goes under the hood, the players on the field from each perspective could reenact it, what they thought happened. That would be a good use of time. Or maybe a team on a bye week. That's how they shouldn't actually go to the replay. They should just have a team on the bye week reenact it, like in JFK, back and to the left. And then we'll get an understanding of what really happened.
I really do wonder if somebody is going to do it, if like all of the streams are going to cross and there's going to be like an kneeling during the anthem celebration.
I'm kind of surprised that a team hasn't sort of gathered in the end zone. Everybody mimes drawing a number 7 on their jersey and a big fro, and then they all drop to a knee.
Stay tuned.
Feel free. Steelers, Juju, if you're listening.
Stay tuned. All right. Whimsy cavalcade. It must go on, Stefan. I was watching the Miami Notre Dame shellacking in a bar on Saturday night. And we've talked about, again, like many times over the years of doing the show, about like the things that really pop with non-sports fans, or if you're watching a game, Mike, with somebody who doesn't really follow stuff that closely, like what are the things that people notice? And I have like rarely seen a phenomenon like the Miami turnover chain, where it's like instantly everyone who is at the table who like doesn't care at all about sports. It was like 15 minutes of conversation about the awesomeness of the turnover chain, like the history of the turnover chain. It is the greatest marketing thing for college football that I have seen in my lifetime, Mike Pesca.
I totally agree. And that as a criteria for how are we communicating, I do it all the time since my kids are, you know, more interested in things other than the turnover chain, and my girlfriend definitely isn't. But when there are a thing or two, when a thing or two pops and you can say, hey, look at this, and they get interested in it, then you know you've got something. And it doesn't always have to be ancillary nonsense. It could be a specific play, a great play. It could be, you know, you can explain a specific theme. Leagues should pay attention more to that. It doesn't mean just a cavalcade of shtick. You know, that's what Gruden brings to the broadcast. No one cares about your turkey zones, your turkey holes, or whatever the hell he was talking about the other week. Yeah, the turnover chain
is
great.
I don't know what you're talking about. But it sounds awesome.
There was this key play in the game, and instead of going to the replay to see if there was a fumble, they went to a pre-package to talk about throwing the ball between defenders, which he called like the turkey nugget. I don't know, something with a turkey.
Turkey.
But
hole.
The turnover chain hole, is yeah. Great. It doesn't seem forced. Like playing for the little brown jug is fine, and it's quote unquote tradition, but obviously the players are so motivated by the turnover chain. And when you're getting them to play for free and they have to be motivated by something, remember, most players choose a school for, you know, what quality of free footwear they could get. The turnover chain works on every level.
So we're working on a non-traditional narrative structure here where we talk about how great the turnover chain is without actually explaining what the turnover chain is. Shall I, Stefan, or
ahead.
Do you want to?
No, go ahead.
All right. So before the season, Miami defensive coordinator Manny Diaz had the idea that was inspired in part by Alabama has like a wrestling belt that they give. And Stefan, I think the good note taker that he is, has a bunch of other examples where if a player has a really good game, if a defensive player forces a turnover, they'll get to like parade around with this wrestling belt. And so in true Miami fashion, he had the idea to create a piece of distinctive jewelry. And so this thing is like a Cuban link necklace. According to this piece in the Sun Sentinel, there are 900 orange and green sapphire stones. It's a 6.5-inch wide U attached to a 36-inch, 2.5-kilogram, 10-carat gold chain. It debuted in the Miami opener against Bethune-Cookman.
And didn't Vince Wilfork have something to do with its acquisition?
Vince Wilfork had something to do with its acquisition. He was like in the store. I think it was his idea to make it a Cuban link necklace.
He was in the jewelry
like a
store.
Really, really...
He was in the jewelry store when the coach called the jewelry store owner to say, hey, we want to make a chain.
Anthony John Machado, better known as AJ. Mike Rumpf, who is a former player who's now the cornerback's coach, was also involved in the transaction. And so whenever a Miami player forces a turnover, they put this thing on and just like, you know, there's a whole ceremony behind it. And then they just like sit on the bench for the entire next series wearing this extremely fat, blinged out chain. And Miami's undefeated. They kicked Notre Dame's ass on
Saturday. Because of turnovers.
Mostly because of turnovers. So, Stefan, it does seem like not only is this like a great marketing thing, it seems extremely effective and motivating.
It's been proven that this kind of thing is motivating.
It's proven by science.
It's proven by sports and coaching over the years. One of the first things I learned when I started coaching in kindergarten was that if you create some sort of totem for the players, they will love it. This is just pure human psychology. I mean, my player, and I think I've talked about this on the podcast before, was this Barbie dressed up in the uniform of our team, which was called the Power, and it's still called the Power, but we don't do the Barbie anymore because they're in 10th grade. And she was Power Bar, and we would give her out after every game as a motivating tool, and then the girls would dress her up during the week and bring her back next Saturday for the next game.
Also Vince Wilfork's idea, strangely.
Vince Wilfork, he's my assistant coach.
So, Stefan, quickly run through the other parallels to the Alabama ball out belt.
Tennessee's got the turnover trash can, where if you turn the ball over, you get to go spike the ball in a trash can.
Butch Jones recently fired, I think in large part due to the lameness of the turnover trash can. There was one game I recall seeing where a player went over to like dunk the ball in the can and it missed. You don't want to have the possibility error when you're giving this award out.
Right, which is why Memphis's takeaway belt and Georgia's spiked shoulder pads, I think, fit the bill better than the turnover trash can.
When he missed the turnover trash can, the announcer said, well, that's why he plays defensive back.
The best one, though, I think, by proclamation on the internet is at Kennesaw State. It's the turnover plank. And it's a piece of wood that is painted to look like the plank from the Cartoon Network series Ed, Edd n Eddy. And he gets passed around. The plank gets passed around by the team, gets dressed up.
It is a piece of wood
literally,
with a smiley face on it.
It is a piece of wood with a smiley face on it.
All right. The end of our whimsy spectacular. And what a spectacular it's been. Let's just all revel in
what adjective
the return
would you
of
use
whimsy.
To describe
Can I add one more? Can I add one more favorite thing about the turnover chain?
Do it.
That there was a chyron on the television screen after one of the turnovers that identified the player as turnover chain recipient.
It's changing the way that sports broadcasting works
and
in America.
I happened to turn over to the UConn-Stanford women's basketball game, and the announcer literally said, after UConn forced the turnover, UConn's got the turnover chain rolling right now.
Mm.
An Olympic champion, Kyle Snyder, wrestler, on Twitter was showing off his latest victory for Ohio State. He had a pin chain because he had pinned his opponent. It's happening. It's taking over. All right. So Miami just beat the snot out of Notre Dame. This fueled in large part by the turnover chain. But let's listen to the Notre Dame defensive coordinator before the game, inspiring his team to what would be a rip-roaring defeat in Miami.
The turnover chain and the Miami defense and how they swarm and how they run and how great they are. And yeah, I'm fucking sick of it. I'm sick of it. You go out tonight and you show the world what this fucking group is all about. You hear me? They can have the chain. We get in the fucking ring.
They really did show the world what they were all about. That's for sure. They lived up to that promise. So Mike Elko probably will not be listening to this segment. But my favorite motivational speech from this last week came from the president of Utah Valley University. They were up by 9 against Kentucky and John Calipari in the season opener.
At halftime.
This was big for Utah Valley. And for whatever reason, the school president decided to come into the locker room and give the basketball team a motivational speech. Let's listen to that.
You guys, you need to know something. When I came here 8.5 years ago, there was a big question about whether this university could even survive. We were growing fast. We didn't have enough money. No one believed in us.
That's really what you want to hear when you're at halftime. Like, how can we, State of Kentucky, let's get a little talk from our president about how the school was on the verge of bankruptcy a few years ago. That seems extremely appropriate. Kentucky would go on an 18-0 run out of halftime and would win by 10.
I guess it didn't work.
Stefan, you have spent the last few days compiling some of your favorite ever motivational speeches. Maybe before we get to that, I wonder, Mike, do you have a theory of the motivational speech? When it motivates, when it doesn't motivate? Are we being unfair by just focusing on the results? Maybe if Mike Elko hadn't given that speech, Miami would have won by 100 points.
Yeah, no, I think the motivational speech as such never works. I think motivational coaches with different ways to motivate work. You only hear about it afterwards. It's like a ropes course or a trust building exercise. Like when things go south, why did pets.com collapse? Well, not enough ropes courses. You know, it's very tangential to the actual bottom line, I think. But when things are going good, you can point to it and say, what a great motivational speech, slash me falling backwards and being caught by Al at accounts receivable.
Good segue coming up here, Mike. You mentioned ropes. Let's talk about the rope. Everyone apparently does the rope in college sports, or some people do the rope in college sports. Let's listen to this clip. This is Louisiana Lafayette Ragin' Cajuns coach Mark Hudspeth before the New Orleans Bowl in 2011.
Grab that rope tight, because I'm telling you what's fixing to happen. They're fixing to roll out right for the opening kickoff. The opening kickoff, Dexter, they're going to come out and say, give me the freaking rope. They're going to come and try to grab the rope. They're going to try to jerk out of your hand. They're going to try to bring that rope and say, no, and you're going to let go. You're going to let go of the rope. They don't know, do they? They don't know. They don't know you ain't going to let go of the rope. They don't know about us.
The rope is symbolic of team unity. He also kicked a garbage can in there for effect, which I liked.
What else you got for us, Stefan?
Well, you got your movies and your real life, right?
Right.
That was real life. I think your movie speeches, I think we can argue about this. I mean, the four that I identified, Newt Rockne, All-American, because I think that would be a nice contrast with the Notre Dame speech and the original Newt Rockne speech, which is very different from the movie speech. You know, and then you got Hoosiers, Rudy, Miracle, Herb Brooks, Miracle on Ice.
Which one of those do you want to play for us?
Should we start us up? Let's fire us up with the original, the actual speech by Newt Rockne at halftime in 1928 in the game against Army.
Now, the success of any team, man, based on team play, same as it's shown all year, sacrifice, unselfish sacrifice. These other fellas, they say, are pretty good, but I think we're better. And I think if we get ourselves keyed up to a point, we're confident of that, why, the results will take care of themselves.
What do you think of that, Mike?
That's a good speech because in the movie Rudy, he lip syncs to that speech, doesn't he? Or he lip syncs to one of the speeches from Newt Rockne, All-America. Or All-American, maybe when the Breaks are beating the boys. Maybe it's the Gipper speech, but it's one of those.
Yeah, that's real life, though. That was not from the movie.
He sounds like Katharine Hepburn in His Girl Friday.
Or Edward G. Robinson. I think he also sounds a little like Edward. Yeah, there's a second part of that I wanted to play, too, which is the more famous part.
And don't forget we're going to pick on one tackle they've got this week. We're going inside them. We're going outside them. Inside them and outside them. And when we get them on the run once, we're going to keep them on the run. And we're not going to pass unless our secondary comes up too close. But don't forget, man, we're going to get them on the run. We're going to go, 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 go. And we aren't going to stop until we go to that goal line. Don't forget, man, today's the day we're going to win. They can't lick it. And from the black out of the goal, the first whistle of the man went there. Fight, 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 fight. What do you say, man?
Not like super complicated in terms of the messaging.
It was a simpler
fight,
time.
Also fight and fight, also fighting and fight, 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 fight.
All right, Hoosiers, Rudy, Miracle. I think we should go with Al Pacino in Any Given Sunday because it really is a great motivating. I'm motivated when I listen to this. Here we go.
The inches we need are everywhere around us. They're in every break of the game, every minute, every second. On this team, we fight for that itch. On this team, we tear ourselves and everyone else around us to pieces for that itch. We claw with our fingernails for that itch. Because we know when we add up all those inches, that's gonna make the fucking difference between winning and losing. Between living and dying.
I don't know if that would motivate the players on the team who are really into the metric system, though.
Mm-hmm. It seems more like that living and dying thing seems like something that Oliver Stone put on to show why his movie resonates beyond mere football. And an actual football coach would not bring in between living and dying as his culmination. The culmination would be more like, and this is why we have to stop the Bengals on third down.
Also, I think Pacino is cheating by just having that music pipe into the locker room.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You can't do that.
And that music, when I hear it now, it does make me think of Friday Night Lights. I think Friday Night Lights stole that sort of music because they use that a lot in the show.
It makes me think of Scent of a Woman because that was the exact same character.
Mike Pesca, great to have you back. Whimsy Cavalcade 2017. We'll get the shirts made up. The Gist every day. You can listen to it. Thank you, Mike.
You're welcome. Thank you. Great to be back.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase, every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch, subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
And now it is time for After Balls. I think we should honor an early touchdown celebrant. Josh, what do you say?
We just like literally talked about that right before we started recording. I think you need to just be more transparent with the listeners.
So you still agree?
Yes.
You still agree.
Let's
okay.
do that.
First guy to spike the ball, Homer Jones of the New York Giants, wide receiver, 1965. And apparently he called it a spike.
It was present from the creation.
Yeah.
The spike.
And it's lasted. It's lived. The name is lived too.
Good job, Homer.
Josh, what's your Homer Jones?
Back in my day, Stefan.
I remember Homer Jones. I'm that
good.
Old.
Thank you for thanking.
Well, that's where my day began.
Thank you for adding that reminiscence.
Not in 1965, though. I do not remember Homer Jones from 1965.
As I was saying, back in my day, there was no easy way to get real-time scores of the games you cared about or, frankly, the games you didn't care about. You could call a phone line. It was intended for the use of compulsive gamblers. Or you could wait for the updates on ESPN at 28 and 58 minutes after the hour. Failing that, there was the late local news or sports center, or heaven forfend, the box scores and the newspaper the next morning. You remember those?
I do.
In 2017, my friends, options abound. I can look on the internet to get the scores I need and don't need, and I can access the internet on my pocket telephone. ESPN doesn't just give you the scores at 28 and 58 anymore. There's a ticker at the bottom of the screen all the time, and you just have to wait for those sweet, sweet scores to roll on past.
This is so informative.
Now having established the scene for you, that's called establishing the scene, let me take you inside the Levine home this Saturday. LSU Arkansas, noon kickoff, ESPN. Tigers up 7-0, looking good. Good job, Tigers. go. But there are other games going on, and attention must be paid to the entire landscape. At 12:19 p.m. and 47 seconds, while the ESPN camera is lingering on the Liv Moss Taco Bell student section, Taco Bell, Liv Moss, we get a score alert on the strip at the bottom of this of the screen. It's presented by Jared, the Galleria of Jewelry. Jared, the Galleria of Jewelry. 5 seconds later, so we started at 12:19:47. We're now at 12:19:52. The score alert banner peels away. So there's been 5 seconds worth of suspense. What am I being alerted to? Aha, college football score. Number 15, Oklahoma State on the road against Iowa State. Number 21, the score, it's rendered in black text on a white background. It's 0-0 with 10:02 to play in the first quarter. All right, 3 seconds later, Stefan, 12:19:55, the alert has arrived. There's a 6 next to Iowa State. It's in white text on a red background. It's eye-catching. I've been alerted. 6-0 Iowa State. All right, let's fast forward 1 second. 12:19:56. It's still there, the white 6 on the red background next to Iowa State. 12:19:57. Still 6-0 Iowa State. Seems like Iowa State has scored a touchdown. This much is clear. All right, let's move forward in play here. We've now arrived at 12:19:58, 6-0 Iowa State still. But wait, a design change. The red background has disappeared. So now it's Iowa State with a black 6 leading Oklahoma State, which still has 0. 12:19:59, the NCAA score alert presented by Jared, the Galleria of Jewelry, tells us that the score remains Iowa State 6, Oklahoma State nothing. All right, move forward 1 second. 12:20:0, still 6-0. All right, let's move forward another second. It's still Iowa State 6, Oklahoma State 0. I've lived an eternity in the 14 seconds since the score alert banner came on screen. 12:20:02, the red background has returned. That, oh wait, Stefan, there's a white numeral. It's now Iowa State 7, Oklahoma State nothing. The Taco Bell student section remains on screen. So what point am I making here? You might be asking. You seem confused. That is a full 7 seconds between when we saw that Iowa State had 6 and when the ESPN ticker operator or the ESPN ticker algorithm deigned to tell us that the Cyclones had made the extra point. To be clear, it wasn't like ESPN was waiting to find out if Iowa State had made the extra point. At 12:15, almost 5 full minutes before the ESPN score alert, we got this update from the official Oklahoma State Cowboys Twitter account. Iowa State benefits from an OK State penalty that kept the drive alive. Not particularly generous, but whatever. And the Cyclones take an early 7-0 lead. This is at 12:15 p.m. Also, so ESPN knew that Iowa State had made the extra point a full 5 minutes before they made us wait 7 seconds to learn that Iowa State had made the extra point. Also, to be clear, 7 seconds is a really long time. All right, I've got my stopwatch out here, Stefan. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be silent for 7 seconds. This is the amount of time I had to wait to see if Iowa State had made the extra point.
Do I have to be silent?
You have to be silent, too.
Okay.
Here we go. So that is how long I had to wait to see if Iowa State made the extra point. Why don't they just put 7-0 up there? So, Stefan, you might argue because ESPN, perhaps alone among our institutions in this nation, recognized that the extra point is a play that stands alone. Mm-hmm. It deserves attention, acclaim, and respect. Does it deserve 7 full seconds of waiting?
It deserves a few seconds. That's a reference to the title of my book.
It is. Very good. Good marketing. This is how far we've come in terms of what we expect.
Things were much simpler when all you had to do was dial 976-1313.
Yeah, you called
to
and it was
all the sports news.
You called and it was 6-0. Then you called back 15 minutes later and you found out that they'd made the extra
and
point.
And that was worth the 50 cents.
All right. This is my plea to you, ESPN. Do not make me wait. Just put the 6 or the 7 or the 8 or however many they score in the sequence, and then we'll know what happened right away. That's all I ask. Thank you, ESPN. Stefan, what is your Homer Jones?
Well, there was some hot elite sports writer on elite sports writer action on Twitter on Sunday. It all started when Sally Jenkins of the Washington Post tweeted about the Duke men's basketball coach's big win over aforementioned Utah Valley the night before. Congrats to Mike Krzyzewski for 1,000 victories. A reminder, he's not the first NCAA Division I coach to do it. That would be Pat Summitt. Well, male human and defender of all things Duke, John Feinstein, wasn't just going to lie down on his 36 books and let Coach K have it. So when Hang Up guest Sally followed with a second tweet noting that Summitt got to 1,000 before she turned 60, while Krzyzewski is already 70, Feinstein was obligated to respond, "Right, Sal, Krzyzewski's nothing but a piker." Thank God someone was there to defend the downtrodden Dookie from the calumny of being compared with a coach who was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease also before turning 60 and died last year at age 64. So Sally, who like Feinstein often engages trolls, replied, "Don't start, John. The point is not superiority. It's that Pat had a lot left to do. How about you drop your tirades for one sec so we can talk about a disease instead of guy insecurities?" Friend of the podcast, Charlie Pierce, tried to break it up. "This is an argument that should not start," he wrote, "but nothing was going to stop this knuckle chucker. I have never put down Pat's achievements," Feinstein fulminated. "I get upset when you and others try to put Mike down. I disagreed with your timing today. That's why I reacted. Probably overreacted." Yes, poor Mike, constantly being put down. What would he do without Feinstein to defend him? Followers jumped in. Some brayed that Pat Summitt had no competition. Others fact-checked that the 1,000 wins are at Duke and that Coach K actually has 1,073, still trailing Summitt's 1,098 for a little while longer. And one guy wondered why everyone was screaming when all Sally did was remind people that, quote, "college basketball is played and coached by men and women both," which is exactly right. It's like when people talk about how the United States has never won a World Cup, except for the three that the women have won. So good for Sally for offering a reality check amid a canonization, ooh, 1,000 wins, for a statistical achievement achieved by others, including Stanford's Tara Vanderveer among coaches of women and Danny Miles of Oregon Tech, Herb McGee of Philadelphia University, which just changed its name to Thomas Jefferson University, and Harry Statham, who after an 88-63 win over Principia on Saturday, has won 1,111 games since he started coaching McKendree University in Lebanon, Illinois, 50 years ago. Anyway, Sally chose to ignore Charlie's advice and escalated things. "My problem is that you talk from ignorance. You don't go near women's hoops and then want to pronounce. Cover the damn sport, then talk. And by the way," she wasn't done, "and by the way, maybe you wouldn't see it as a put down if you'd been to a women's game sometime in the last quarter century." Ooh. "What did I say today about women's hoops, Sally? I don't cover the NBA either, or high school basketball, or a lot of things. I cover what I'm working on." Yeah, what did Feinstein do anyway, other than smart-assedly imply that Sally had in fact put down Krzyzewski when she hadn't? And what did Sally do, other than bring up Summitt's Alzheimer's as a mitigating factor in her victory total? And what did Feinstein do but say that comparing their win totals is apples and oranges? And what did Sally do but then accuse Feinstein of equating Eddie Robinson's wins with Joe Paterno's, while noting that Summitt coached for years, quote, "with secondhand equipment and no funding," end quote? And what did readers do but post GIFs of Jon Stewart eating popcorn and mention how John Wooden had it easy and note that Paterno enabled a pedophile? I would like now to note that 37 college softball coaches have more than 1,000 wins. You go, Phil McSpadden of Oklahoma City University, with your 1,613. And that the wiki list for baseball wins in college starts at 1,100. And the leader, Augie Garrido, retired last year with 1,975 wins. And the dude in second, Mike Martin of Florida State, should pass 2,000 in 2019. And the guy in third, Gordy Gillespie, coached for 59 years, and that UNC women's soccer coach Anson Dorrance has 825 wins, which is 275 more than the next women's coach and 130 more than the next men's coach. In conclusion, Josh, Pat Summitt was a much better coach than Mike Krzyzewski.
When you were talking about relying on the achievements of others, I thought you were going to go to a place that I wish you had gone to, which is that Mike Krzyzewski didn't win any of those damn games.
That is correct. He got paid a shitload of money to do it while his players weren't getting paid, though.
That is our show for today. Our producer is Patrick Fort. To listen to past shows and subscribe or just reach out, go to slate.com/hangup. You can email us at hangup@slate.com. Thanks to the new Twitter character limit, Stefan's entire afterball will be available in a single tweet when you can look forward to reading that. You should also check out John, Emily, and David on the original Unbeatable, Unstoppable Slate Political Gab Fest.
Stephen, new name? The original Stephen, Unbeatable, Unstoppable?
Stephen Colbert says everybody should listen to the Slate Political Gab Fest, and he's extremely famous. Listen to him when he says what you should listen to. You can get new episodes every Thursday evening at slate.com/gabfest. For Stefan Fatsis, I'm Josh Levine. Remember Zelma Obeidy, and thanks for listening.